Okay, so this is a poorly rehearsed talk, so interrupt me if there are any questions about anything that looks strange or ambiguous. So this is a little piece of work I've been thinking about for a while, along with Lars and Evan here and Mike Muno at Caltech. I'm just going to highlight the basic idea very quickly. This will be a short talk, tell you what globular clusters are, what globular cluster systems look like, and what sorts of rates we might expect for globular cluster 1As and why it's interesting. So first, it seems like one of the ideas that's really blossomed in this program is that there's a great deal we don't know about type 1A supernovae, about their progenitors, about the physics of the explosion. Explanations for the diversity among different galaxy types, questions regarding metallicity of 1As, how that affects the explosion characteristics, how the age of the stellar system factors into 1A rates and other sorts of things. And some of these questions are a little disconcerting from the, oh, this stopped working, from the point of view of a cosmological context, in particular in an era where people are thinking of devoting huge amounts of manpower and financial resources to trying to use the 1As for cosmology. It's not clear to what degree any of these issues affect the cosmological results, but it's still an open question. And one of the things we can hope to do to better resolve some of these issues is to better understand the 1A environments. What are the characteristics of the systems in which the 1As explode? And in galaxies, of course, this is fairly difficult. Integrated galaxy properties like star formation rate and crude ages from single stellar population models and metallicities don't necessarily tell you about the conditions in which the 1A formed. They don't tell you about the local conditions like the metallicity and the stellar age, etc. And one way we might be able to address some of these issues is to find a 1A in a globular cluster. In some sense, a globular cluster is everything we would like an old elliptical galaxy to be. It's sort of a monolithic stellar population where all the stars more or less have the same ages and same metallicities. You can't really say that about an elliptical galaxy. Globular clusters are typically very old, cosmologically old. They're associated with galaxy formation events, so that sort of stands to reason. There's large numbers of stars. I mean, as a fraction of the total mass in the galaxy, globular clusters are relatively small as individual units, but of course globular clusters come in large numbers in large galaxies, hundreds to thousands of clusters. And each cluster contains, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of stars. And there's a lot going on in an individual globular cluster because the densities are so high. These are very dynamically active regions. The relaxation times are sort of a billion years. So these are dynamically relaxed old stellar systems. And these dynamical encounters also allow you to form exotic objects like all sorts of binaries, X-ray sources, radio pulsars, and in principle, type 1A supernovae. But I think one of the things that's sort of neat about globulars, unlike their galaxies at large, is that we can really measure of course, the luminosity or the mass of the cluster, the age, assuming that all the stars really are the same age, which we can't really say for a large elliptical galaxy, and we can measure the metallicity. And there's a narrow distribution of metallicities among the stars in any individual globular cluster. So these are very meaningful from the point of view of trying to understand 1A progenitors. That's just a typical globular cluster. It's M22, I think. Just highlighting the sort of scale radius in the cluster and the core radius. And these are sort of a few parsecs in size with tidal radii extending to tens of parsecs. So just give you a little background on globular cluster systems and different kinds of galaxies. This is the Sombrero Galaxy, M104. this might be what the globular cluster system around the Milky Way looks something like. There's sort of hundreds of globular clusters here symbolized by all these X's and O's. I think they're metal-rich and metal-poor clusters or blue and red clusters. this just sets a scale, but it emphasizes that these clusters are really sort of a halo population, like the halo stars. So they're very spatially extended, which is nice from the point of view of 1A studies, because you can hope to find a globular cluster 1A in a region of low galaxy surface brightness. So that's a spiral. This is the radial profile for the globular cluster population in M87. This is a beast. M87 is a beast by itself. It's a CD galaxy in Virgo, but it also contains upwards of 10,000 globular clusters. And they extend out to very large radii. I mean, here's the halo light scaled. I think it's normalized sort of arbitrarily. But, you know, that sort of piddles off at 5 to 10 arc minutes. Here, 5 arc minutes is about 30 kiloparsecs in this galaxy. The globular cluster profile extends out to 200 kiloparsecs, beyond which, you know, it's hard to actually identify individual globulars. The density more or less follows something like a de Vaucouleurs profile. It's also interesting that the metal poor and metal rich populations tend to have different spatial distributions, metal poor being the blue clusters, metal rich being characterized by red photometric colors. The blue clusters extend to large radii, and people are investigating how that links to galaxy formation and other sorts of interesting things.
Wait, Eric, are you saying that some of the red and the blue is really does follow the Vaucouleurs profile?
At least in this galaxy. It's not quite the same from galaxy to galaxy, but it's often sort of consistent with the Vaucouleurs. Sometimes it looks more power law-like, but the stars do that too sometimes. As I said, we can measure metallicities. These are colors. These are Hubble ACS observations of a couple Virgo globular cluster systems for two different galaxies. Often it's the case, in particular in elliptical galaxies, that there's some kind of a bimodal distribution metallicities of these clusters. And the values of these colors, these G minus Z colors, map on more or less via a linear relation to the FV over H value. So this peak down here at low metallicities is about a 30th solar, and the higher metallicity peak is about a 1/3 solar. But by and large, they're all very much subsolar metallicities.
What are the G and Z?
I forget what the wavelengths are, but it's sort of...
SDSS and E is about 40,000 something, and Z is 9,000.
Yeah. So yeah. So that was the metallicity distribution. There's also the luminosity function. That's very regular from cluster system to cluster system. You go from galaxy to galaxy. People have proposed that one can use this to measure galaxy distances, and it's been fairly successful in that regard. Typical case, and in most cases, the average absolute V magnitude of the cluster, of the cluster population, is sort of minus 7.5. That corresponds to a cluster mass of around 200,000 solar masses. The dispersion here does vary from galaxy to galaxy, and it's loosely correlated with the galaxy mass, but it's typically around 1 to 1.5 magnitudes. This is for our galaxy, that's the Milky Way, and these are just two random samples from the Virgo Hubble ACS observations, and you know they're very Gaussian-like, they're very regular. But you know, it's important to point out there are, you know, above 7.5, minus 7.5, there are quite a few massive galaxies, and if you're thinking in terms of 1As, these are the ones that are preferentially going to. These are the ones that are preferentially going to host exotic stellar objects just by virtue of their mass. So even if your survey only goes down to an apparent VMAG of 26, you might be sampling 10 to 15% of the cluster population by number, but you're getting more than half of the cluster mass. So even if you're somewhat limited from ground-based observations, you can still, in principle, capture a lot of the mass in the cluster system. The observers of globular cluster populations typically quote the numbers of clusters in terms of this specific frequency, SN, which is basically the number of globular clusters in the field monitored divided by some the light scaled in some way. This corresponds to like 10 to the 8 solar luminosities or something like that. It's scaled so that the specific frequency comes out to be of order unity, basically. It's somewhat arbitrary. But for spirals and ellipticals, there's a difference. There's a systematic difference. For spirals, the specific frequency tends to be somewhat lower, reflecting lower globular cluster population numbers. That presumably has something to do with the survival, the dynamical survival of globular clusters in different types of galaxies. In disk galaxies, there's more tidal shocking and a higher rate of evaporation of individual clusters than in elliptical galaxies, which have more smooth density distributions. So, you know, the number can go up to 10,000 in some giant elliptical galaxies. Typically, though, it's of order thousands in sort of typical type elliptical galaxies, and then the higher specific frequency reflects that.
So, Eric, yeah. This higher number is not a consequence of the fact that the elliptical is the result of multiple mergers of spirals where it retains the globular classical plate.
Presumably that's part of it. Yeah. And CD galaxies have higher specific frequencies than field ellipticals in a given cluster or in just field in general. Specific frequency, I mean, I say 2 to 5 is typical. M87 has a specific frequency of around 15. So it's massive. And 1399, the CD in Fornax, has a similar specific frequency. But not all CDs show that. The CD in the Coma cluster has sort of a more typical SN of 5 or something like that. But it's harder to study that because it's 100 megaparsecs away. But it can be. It can be studied. No? You don't want to respond? There you go. So what I'd like to do is translate that specific frequency into some more meaningful number that we can use to actually get rates for type 1a supernovae. So I want to compute the mass fraction of globular clusters. So it's the total mass of the globular cluster system as a whole divided by the galaxy mass. So if we know how the 1a rate scales with galaxy mass, then we can translate that into a 1a rate for the globular cluster system. And so after you crank the machine here, and translate and write this in terms of the specific frequency, it's sort of 10 to the minus 3 for a specific frequency of 1, where M5 is the average globular cluster mass in units of 10 to the 5 solar masses, and this epsilon V is the stellar mass to light ratio of the galaxy. So this might be 2, this might be 3 or 5 or something like that, depending on the galaxy. So this is sort of of order unity. And so this translates to a simple memorable result of around 10 to the minus 3 for a specific frequency of 1. Now, as I said, for ellipticals, that number is sort of 3 or 5 or something very often. And so this might be a few tenths of a percent on average. So it's a small fraction of the mass, which would suggest that it's a very small fraction of the 1a rate. Let me just go through this too. This is actually how one gets the rate. So this is the low Z, all sky, type 1a supernova rate. This is everything, roughly speaking, a few times 10 to the minus 5 per year per cubic megaparsec. So out to a distance of 100 megaparsecs, which is roughly how far away you can be and still understand the globular cluster population, where you can see a large fraction of the globular clusters is a high degree of completeness. It's about 100 per year. Now, this is just a chosen number. I mean, it might be closer, it might be farther, depending on the galaxy and the environment and the type of observation, whether it's from the ground or from space. So this is everything, and something like a few percent of that, if I did this correctly, a few percent of that to 10% of that would be associated just with the mass as opposed to the star formation rate. And this I'm just using the stuff that Lars and Evan did. Does that sound?
Well, the legacy survey results, if they go up, they probably will.
Yeah.
This number will go up. Okay. The legacy got a lower
normalization
of star formation rate than what was in the original evolution rate. So if that holds up, then that says that low redshift with a higher fraction from the mass.
Okay. Well, even better. In any case, if one takes this sort of 10% at face value, then you're sort of getting a few per century within 100 megaparsecs associated with just this mass piece. Okay, and this is there's no globular.
Sorry, what's this mass piece?
Lars?
It's just that if you take the 1A rate, you see an elliptical, and divide it by the mass, you get a 1A per mass.
No, I understand. Yeah, yeah, I understand. In any case, there's a fraction of this that we can associate with the mass. So if we have the mass efficiency for globular clusters, we can just multiply by all these normalization factors. So if we take that sort of 10 to the 3 or a few times 10 to the minus 3 or a few times 10 to the minus 3, for this mass fraction, multiply by a few percent and 100 per year, we might get something like a few per century of, for globular cluster 1As within 100 megaparsecs, where we can hope to actually measure the properties of individual globular clusters.
Now you assume that they just the frequency goes just like it is in the normal stellar population.
Of course, yeah. So there's more to come.
Okay.
Yeah. So globular clusters are dynamically active environments. Now, we've known for several decades that things like neutron star low mass X-ray binaries, blue stragglers, binary millisecond radio pulsars, all sorts of exotic objects are overabundant in globular clusters by factors of order 100. This is especially true for neutron star low mass X-ray binaries. So this is an overabundance per unit mass compared to the field of the galaxy, so outside the globular clusters. We just add up the total mass, add up the total number of systems, and compute these ratios. So, in fact, I think it's something like, you know, it's estimated to be something like 300, I think, initially, for neutron star low mass X-ray binaries. And so why shouldn't a similar overabundance, maybe a factor of 10, maybe even a factor of 100, apply to 1As in globular clusters? We have available dynamical formation channels for 1A progenitors that simply aren't accessible in the field. Exchange encounters involving massive white dwarfs. It's very easy to produce double white dwarf binaries in globular clusters. Stellar collisions between a white dwarf and a giant star also makes a double white dwarf binary ultimately. Again, something that's completely inaccessible in the field. Dynamical encounters will also produce binaries consisting of a white dwarf and a giant star. So some of the single degenerate channels are also enhanced. Some of these things have been investigated by a couple people, Mike Schar and Jared Hurley and Natasha Ivanova and collaborators in a more recent paper. So it's at least plausible, just you know, from as a matter of principle, that the dynamical enhancement could easily be a factor of 10 for these clusters. Now, this also depends on the cluster age. You know, all these things vary with time as the cluster evolves, and so this factor of 10 may apply to old systems, but not to young systems, or it might be lower, or it might be higher. But
this completely depends on the hardness of the binary. I mean, if you have a symbiotic, which in a global environment is a fairly soft binary, mm-hmm. you may actually destroy them.
Absolutely.
So
it could lead to
not an enhancement, but the vision of.
Well, yeah, I mean, the hard-soft boundary in a globular cluster is typically around an AU or something. So you still have available everything, you know, if you're ruling out the symbiotic scenario with sort of a wind accretion picture for very wide detached binary. So you cut that out, but you're still left with everything else.
Yeah, so if the 1As are from a hard component, mm-hmm. then you're overabundant probably, but if they're from soft, then...
I agree. But these are the questions that, of course, we you know all these things need to address. So, you know, if it's as high as a factor of 10 or a factor of 100, then this few per century becomes much more interesting. It becomes a few per decade, a one per year or something, maybe at the extreme. Yes?
I'm sorry for maybe you talked about this earlier, but let me play devil's advocate. If you're advocating for that big of a rate, where are they?
Oh, well, you wouldn't know it. I'll get to that in a little bit. Yeah.
Another question was that things like the blue stragglers, is there a downside to that in terms of basically rejuvenating?
Well, that's an interesting caveat. So one of the possibilities, of course, is that, you know, we say this is an old stellar system.
Yeah,
so old means, you know, turn-off mass is 0.8 solar masses or something like that. So if you require a supersoft channel that has an intermediate mass donor of 1.5 solar masses and up, then old means you don't have those. However, if there are stellar collisions between two turnoff stars, you might be able to create an intermediate mass star. And as long as you can get a white dwarf as a companion, or a fairly massive white dwarf, it still has to be a quite massive white dwarf, then maybe you can do it. I tend to think that's relatively rare, but I don't happen to know the number offhand. So that is a slight caveat to some of these statements. Okay, so how do we find them? This sort of goes with Frank's question. So the first thing to do is, of course, you know, check the archive of the things we have. there are something like 100 type 1a supernovae within 40 or 50 megaparsecs over the past century or something. So we can go back and we can look at images of the galaxies or propose for deeper images with Hubble or something else to see what's there. But most of these 1As just haven't been followed up. I mean, we don't know what's at the position of the 1A. Or in many cases where there are Hubble observations, the Wittpick field is so small that it might not actually capture the position of the 1A. So there, we've gone, yes?
I just wanted to point out that we did have a snapshot survey of large number of nearby 1As to look for light echoes.
Yes.
And so there are at least 50 in there, and I think there's actually was a proposal to continue that. In
these are all years after the 1A, or just all the old archival?
So everything before that.
Okay.
There's, not colors or anything, but high-resolution images.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, so that's we should talk about that. Yeah.
Stuff in there that's actually pointed at the position of these.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's worth looking into.
And we
weren't looking for globular clusters.
All right, so that's the important point.
We find three light echoes. The light echoes look slightly different. If there were a globular cluster, what you have to do is plunk down the error of the position of the supernova, and sometimes there are several sources in there that look like clumps. So, you might not be sure whether it was a globular cluster or not, but you would find some possibilities there.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we should look into that a little more deeply. So we've done some of this, just looking through the archive, looking through some existing images, and found a few candidates that were interesting. We went through the catalog and we flagged things within 3,000 kilometers per second and with relatively large offsets from their host galaxies, like an arc minute or something like that. And we found sort of half a dozen interesting candidates. One sort of struck my interest. I don't know. I mean, it's just sort of interesting in its own right. It's NGC 5061 has two type 1As that have gone off in the past decade, 2 and 10 years. All right, so you're going to see that eventually. But they're both more than an arc minute offset from the center of the galaxy. They're both beyond like 10 kiloparsecs from the galaxy. And I don't think there is a deep image that covers the positions of the 1As, but maybe you have something. 2000, it's 1996X and 2005 CN, I think.
96X we probably have HST images for, as I recall.
That's, okay, cool. All right, and it's like 42 megaparsecs away. So with an HST image, you should see a globular.
That's cool. Fast decliner, 1996X.
Yeah. So anyway, there are a few.
No, all of them.
It'll be 2000. Yeah. Where's Bob Kirshner? Maybe he memorized them all.
Anyway, so there are a few items of interest, sort of in the current catalog, that are worth following up, worth further study. So in sort of the modern era, one of the things we would have to do if there aren't existing images, and maybe that'll change as the years go by, but of course we need late time follow-up of these 1As. I mean, these are 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 solar luminosities. The cluster luminosities are 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. We have to wait a while for the 1A to decline before the globular cluster starts to show itself. And this is just, this is a particularly bright 1A. And at least for this case, if our globular cluster typical absolute magnitude is 7.5, these bands are just the 1 sigma sort of for the luminosity function, then we have to wait for, over 1 or 2 years before the cluster light starts to take over. And we can sort of fuzz this a little bit sort of to capture more typical 1As. But, we still, even for fainter 1As, we still have to wait typically in excess of a year for the cluster light to dominate, where you can actually start to see the cluster if there isn't a pre-existing image. I'm a theorist, so I don't know how reasonable this is, but since the rate for 1As within something like 100 megaparsecs is 100 per year, that strikes me as a relatively modest number. And if you're targeting things that look like they might be associated with globulars, large offsets, elliptical galaxies, that cuts it down even further. So it seems like we should and probably can actually do late time observations, late time spectroscopic observations for all the 1As of interest for this globular cluster study. It doesn't seem like it's asking for too much, and of course the benefits are pretty interesting. So what do we learn? I mean, I've already talked about some of these issues. Well, if we see more than one, we can start to do statistics for the globular cluster 1As. We can see if, you know, if they're different. Are they the subluminous variety of 1As? Do their peak light curves, do the peak luminosities look different? Do their light curves look different from typical 1As? Because in globular clusters, I mean, we have these dynamical channels that aren't accessible in the field. So, you know, maybe the progenitors are systematically different. Maybe they're preferentially double degenerates. This is this plot that some version of which has shown up a number of times during this program. Where, you know, if we look at late times, I don't necessarily believe all the single degenerate details, but, you know, if we look at late times, it's at least possible that the double degenerates dominate the rate. So for something that, you know, really is old, dynamically speaking, in terms of star formation, maybe we'll preferentially get the double degenerates, and maybe they're systematically different. Now, the same ideas would apply to an old elliptical galaxy, but do we really know elliptical galaxies are old? There's this frosting issue that has come up where, you know, maybe in some ellipticals there's some 1-giga-year-old population that's maybe of order a percent or a few percent by mass, and maybe that accounts for the 1A. So maybe the 1A progenitors truly aren't truly from the old population. And the globular cluster 1As could address some of that.
Where do you guys figure, right, that in some sense possibly the brazier, the area under those curves would be...
I don't know. I just grabbed this from one of his papers. I'm not sure about the normalizations. I think they're normalized in the same way, the same sort of specific star formation rate, but I'm not sure.
Is this just for globular?
No, this is just for a starburst. So you have a starburst, you let everything age, and you see what the 1A rate is, a function of time.
And they say most of them would come from double
degeneration. At late times, that's what that would suggest. But, you know, we don't really understand the 1A progenitors very well. I don't know why it's not here, but there is a tail that goes off to 10 giga years for the single degenerate population if you have a 0.8 solar mass giant donor. I mean, it's there. Why it's not included there, I'm not sure, but it does exist.
It's included, but it's very low.
Okay. All right, so that's...
And then why is the area under the double degenerate curve so vastly larger than the area under the single degenerate?
I don't think it's not D-Lonti. I don't think it's that much bigger.
Okay.
Right.
That's true.
It's 10^8
and 10^9
and 10^13.
It's not
D-Lonti.
And there are versions of this type of calculations that
look,
where
they look different. Yeah.
The peak is 5 times higher.
Yes. Yes.
The positive lobe is 5 times
higher.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of the point. Is you sort of can have anything you want, and the observations don't constrain anything. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I like this globular cluster idea. Metallicities are also important. I mean, stuff that Frank has looked at and Lars is looking at now, you know, maybe that affects the explosion. Since globular clusters are typically low metallicity, they're going to be, in principle, different than higher metallicity environments. Frosting issue, obviously, maybe constrain the progenitors. If we get a rate for the globular cluster 1As, I mean, that's also interesting for progenitor models, and it's also interesting just from the point of view of cluster dynamics. These dynamical formation channels that are sort of exotic aren't accessible in the field, and I hope that this kind of idea prompts further study on those things. And that's it. I should leave something up. Yes.
When this very high incidence of X-ray binaries was discovered. It was discovered actually by Rokurski in 1973 in globular clusters, and it came that it's about 1,000 times larger incidence of Lagrange 6-ray binaries than in the galaxy as a whole. It's because the neutron stars are also a little bit more massive than the average star, so they sink to the center. Now, the massive white dwarfs would also do that. I would think particularly the oxygen neon magnesium ones would, because they are the most massive ones, they sink to the center. But You also have carbon oxygen ones, I think, of 1.1 or something like that. So you would preferentially make binaries out of the more massive white dwarfs, I would think.
It's not a, I mean, it's sort of a linear scaling or something. It's not a very sensitive dependence on the mass. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they would pick up companions like the neutron stars have done. They pick up normal star companions, so you would do that also. Mm-hmm. But you would also probably pick up white dwarf companions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so you would, I mean, we have now, aren't there three double neutron stars in globular clusters?
The only one that I know of. And
yeah, but there was a rumor that the Pulsar guys in Australia find a couple more.
I thought there was. Wasn't there one with a massive white dwarf?
I don't know if they know.
That could. Yeah, I don't remember actually. But I heard some rumor that there were three of them in the globular cluster system.
It's very easy to make double neutron stars in globular clusters,
yeah,
but most of them are.
The famous one, which looks exactly like the
Stellar
Pulsar.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's an 8-hour period with a gravitational and spiral time less than 10 billion years, so it's interesting.
And these neutron stars are not that much more massive than white
dwarfs, right.
So I think the rate could be really high.
Yeah. Well, and there's just a larger number of white dwarfs.
Yeah, much larger.
And even if you're 0.6 solar masses, just somewhat below the turnoff, mass segregation doesn't strongly deplete those white dwarfs from the core. I mean, it takes, you know, there's some time scale associated with that, but they're always diffusing in, so they're not.
Massive ones will certainly fall into the core.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Very interesting.
So you're sort of limited to the 100 megaparsecs distance scale because you can't recognize the globulars beyond that.
Well, that was somewhere arbitrary. I know there have been detailed globular cluster studies for galaxies in coma.
Right. But suppose that you were to take the higher Z supernovae and sort of plot their distance from the galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that would already give you information on whether this is a halo population or not. I mean, maybe you can't really pinpoint it back to a global cluster, but you should be able to say that the distribution around the galaxy is similar to that of a global cluster distribution.
Yeah, we've looked into that a little bit. I mean, I think it's a difficult exercise because you really want to do some statistical measure, you know, like plot. So one of the things we thought of doing, just sort of as a thought experiment, was take every galaxy, take the half-light radius, see how many are beyond the half-light radius and beyond and inside the half-light radius. You get an excess beyond, then maybe something's going on. But how to actually do a comparison from galaxy to galaxy given selection effects. And, you know, you are missing 1As at the cores of the galaxies.
Sure.
They're very far away. So I'm not sure how to do the exercise properly. If you have any ideas, I'd be happy to hear it. But
I guess you could model it with just a model of galaxy.
Yeah, I think you could. I'm not sure that it would ever be believable, I guess, is sort of the punchline. Maybe there's something that's worth doing. But
perhaps Peter knows better than any of us here. I mean, is there a preference for the 1As to be outside of the, or far outside of the galaxy?
Preference for them to be discovered.
Yeah,
right. Is there a way of telling that they preferentially are on the outside or inside? Or
if we understood the selection effects, yes. And probably not the high Z, but maybe the Sloan would be good where you can pick out the early type galaxies do that experiment because you have a little higher resolution. It hasn't been done.
Is the frosting really much thinner? This gets back to the blue straggler rate. Is that rate way
down? Yeah, that's something I would have to calibrate. I don't know the answer. My suspicion is that it's rare because you're sort of demanding a massive white dwarf and a massive blue straggler. It's not just any blue straggler. You need two turnoff stars basically to come together. So it's asking for a lot, but it's going to happen. I just don't have.
Yeah, no, it's just a question of whether you compared
rate.
To the problems with the frosting.
The number of blue stragglers is relatively low compared to the number of turnoff mass stars.
Yes, and that's because most of the blue stragglers that you make, most of the collision products you make, I should say, aren't twice the turnoff mass.
Right, so they're still hidden in the
Exactly.
Right. But those, I mean, those wouldn't be good enough anyway.
I don't think so. I mean, according to standard population synthesis and evolutionary arguments, but I think all this is up for grabs, so it's hard to make any firm conclusions.
Any other questions? Okay, second. Okay, so I do need a show of hands for...